having a good design eye and aesthetic lies within being able to see so much and being able to understand the value that it's adding into the environment or the value that it's taking away. And so being able to see those nuances in your day to day, that comes through travel, that comes through perpetual learning and having a beginner's mindset and always trying to have self-betterment attitude.
This is a part of a Better Product original series on the business impact of product design. As usual, I'm Christian.
And I'm Anna. Laura Nunnery joins the series as the Senior Product Design Lead at Strava. Before leading design at Strava, Laura worked at Facebook and Instagram using her design skills to address social issues within the product.
If you look at her career, she's been at some of the biggest design-oriented companies that exist today, starting with TurboTax. To take a step back, we asked how she got into product design because her background doesn't follow a path we've shared on this show before.
I had a physics background, and so it doesn't initially feel like it's quite a natural progression into the product design world. But if when you're looking at complex systems and simplifying that within a physics sense or within a design sense, they kind of do go hand in hand. And so the initial career was going into agencies and understanding just the gamut of what's going out there as far as like a visual presence. That was kind of the incubation state. And then from there, I'd take some time off. TurboTax approached and said, I've seen some of your systems work from a physics setting. Would you like to like apply this into a product world? And I was like, that's quite intriguing. And also hardest problem to solve is taxes in my mind. If you can solve that, that's like success. What next? And so that just seemed like a very enticing thing to do. And so not your like natural progression, but it felt right to be able to look at like a holistic viewpoint and then go to the granularities and then kind of solve user problems based on that background.
What I love about her answer is how she found herself in product design. As she mentions, many people find themselves in product via other routes or non-traditional avenues, which gives them a specific type of expertise they can apply to problems in tech.
I think it's anything that comes within the realm of thinking and looking at things differently from different vantage points and aggregating all of those vantage points to one singular output. I think the people that can do that well are the people that go into product design because there's so many edge cases that you have to consider.
With some of this context in mind, let's jump into the conversation, starting with her time at Facebook and the impact the 2016 elections had on her design career.
So at the height of what you probably can all recollect of the media chaos around influence on elections in 2016, that was right as the fruition of my time at Facebook like began. And so when that started initiating, I was on a team called Pages. And so essentially Pages is a place for small businesses and businesses to actually build their network and build a community, have advertising and things like that. And so when we realized within the data at Facebook that it was coming, the source of truth and the mass social engineering was happening within that environment with that affordance of the platform. And so when I started, it was fortunate enough that that team was just spinning up. And so we had to really get down and dirty really, really quickly to actually get to the root of the problem and understand it more and just start from learning. And so I just lucked into it, honestly. And that's kind of the entirety of my career. Everything just kind of falls eloquently into place, although there are like struggles within all of it. I mean, dealing with foreign governments circumnavigating your platform to cause social divide, not something you want to look at every day. It's kind of disheartening.
When we hear about ethics and technology today, I feel like, at least from my personal reaction, is a lot of it's driven by AI and engineering side, but obviously as a designer and designer yourself, I'm curious what you think design's role is in integrity and ethics when it comes to design, and what ability does design, or maybe responsibility does design have in ensuring ethics are upheld?
Yeah, I think design is at the forefront of it. It's an equal partner at the table. If you're not considering how a feature or affordance can be manipulated or abused, then you're not doing your part as a designer, and you're not actually covering the gamut of ways design should actually unfold and the different methodologies. And so in building integrity products, a lot of designers at Facebook had to be educated on what to look out for and what types of abuse can happen. And there's always new ways of abusing being created left and right. And so you always have to have that reactionary model in your brain and always try to combat it. And so that's not something that comes easy for designers, because they want things to be beautiful and they want things to be eloquent and simple and work really fluidly. And so when you're thinking about people abusing something, then it completely puts a wrench in the system. So it's an education gap that we had to work within.
Do you think there's a conflict in between designing something for elegance and simplicity and designing something that is maybe the right thing to do? Or do you think that it's just really about educating people to understand how they all work together?
I think they're one and the same, because it has extra privacy matters or extra things that could be more complicated. I don't think it takes away from the fact of it being needing to be intuitive and easily understood and readily adaptable.
I just realized you mentioned the word affordance, which I think is really well known in the UX design space, but for many of our listeners might not be fully familiar with that term. I'd love to hear maybe an example of when you say an affordance in design and software, what's an example of that and how it could be used negatively?
Yeah, it's just another way to put a feature within a product. So essentially, say if we're looking at the Facebook family of apps, and so specifically with the product I was on, Pages, a particular affordance would be the mechanism of buying an ad or the mechanism of adding an admin. It's another subsequent thing you can actually do within the parent company, if you will, of the feature.
Well, it's really interesting that, I mean, you know, dealing with what was happening in Facebook in 2016 and kind of taking that on. And then you were like, you know what, this isn't a big enough challenge. Now I'd like to deal with bullying. So the idea that you then went to Instagram really focused on overcoming the ability for people to kind of cyberbully each other. So I'm curious a little bit about that transition and what that was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, the transition, I mean, it wasn't easy. There's this external perception of you get a lot of snacks, you get like dinners up the wazoo, et cetera. But the time that I spent within the Pages Facebook team and working on that integrity product in that realm, we were in this state called a lockdown, which is kind of, it's pretty typical within the tech world out here. You get into it like a very intensive, I mean, it could be 2 weeks, it could be 6 months working period, where the issue that you're working at has to have like finite focus and attention to detail, where nothing actually on the peripherals can saturate what you're focusing on. And so within that time span, I was in a lockdown for I think a good 9 months. And so what that meant was it was just heads down, completely working through all these problems, also dealing with senators coming in and giving product recommendations, and then things coming out in the media and different things coming to the surface. And so you had to have like, one, your end goal and ideal state to work toward, but you also had to be able to compartmentalize all of the external chaos and noise. And so leading into that and kind of my exit and that team space, I took 2 months off, went surfing, traveled a little while, and then came back and started Instagram. And so Instagram, within the context of Facebook, it's a few years behind as far as capabilities, as far as machine learning, as far as just any type of infrastructure. And so in coming to that space, I already had knowledge that set precedent of how to apply it to different realms. And we hadn't seen any type of circumnavigating in that space yet. And so in a natural evolution of human behavior, they're going to eventually get to that platform and find the weaknesses. So that felt like a natural progression to kind of go to the Instagram well-being team. And the first start there was within bullying and preventing spam and providing support for suicidal posts or any type of users that might have needed more help. And so it just felt like something that I already had a knowledge base in that I could actually apply really quickly.
How do you determine what is the responsibility of the software that, you're on or the tech that you're running? How do you determine what the responsibility is for the tech that you're building, or how far to go with it?
We just have to like take two steps back and look at the genesis of any type of medium or platform. And there is always going to be some form of harm being displayed on that and it being a conduit to propagate that harm into the masses. And so the issue lies within not actually being able to foreshadow the type of harm, the type of scale and type of social graph you would have to actually propagate that into the masses. And so there's a responsibility, but I also think there is a headspace that needs to be known of this will manifest in any other medium. This will, because these are the ones that were first to market and actually built that user base and expanded so quickly. Those are the ones that are highlighted, but it will literally manifest in all different surfaces. I can't name any type of product that hasn't dealt with any type of abuse of it.
Do you think that this is something that you think all products should almost have as something that they're looking at specifically? Is it, you know, abuse of the product?
Absolutely. I mean, if I think everyone needs to have the mindset going into it that we are humans and animals, and we are coming from a survival mental model, and people will do that to survive. Maybe it's survival within making money. Maybe it's survival within manipulation to fraudulent account, or maybe it's any type of incremental gain that individual can have that will surface in any type of setting. And that has been the nature of our evolution since the dawn of time. So I think everyone needs to actually go in with an integrity mindset first and making sure it can't be manipulated.
You have a lot of experience encountering these big issues inside products. You're not just designing this for revenue outcomes. Like, there are other less measurable things that you're trying to affect. So I'm curious, like, how you would recommend that people learn about that or get better at addressing those types of problems.
Yeah, I think if you come from the most like pristine background with you've never experienced any type of bullying in your life, you've never experienced any type of hardship, then, I mean, best case scenario for their life projection, sure. But I think every single designer, every single human can go into a space being able to relate to what's going on. And so if the vantage point that both were take from a user empathy setting, and then also from just knowing the hardships on a day-to-day and just being hyper-present within all of the ways the world and the material things can saturate your mind, and having that hyper top of mind and always kind of dictating your point of understanding, I think that will definitely help. So it's not necessarily just in being embedded in a product and being able to extract yourself and look at all of the nuanced ways it could be manipulated. It's literally taking your step within the world and seeing the manipulation there. And then you can actually carry that on through to any type of career, any type of product you're building. And it starts with a complete innate understanding that intrinsically humans are going to try to do something harmful, unfortunately.
So we've covered some really heavy side of the ethics of design. And so you've, since 2019, you've been leading design at Strava. And it seems like you've carried some of that with you, but approaching a totally different problem set. Since you started at Strava, what was your main charter that you were trying to achieve, and how have you been working on it since?
It's been a bit of a wild ride, but the most fruitful and growth one I've been on yet. So I've been very grateful for that. So when I started, it functions as a startup, but it's an 11-year-old startup, and it has yet to become profitable. And so in coming into that and coming from a landscape that was so structured and process oriented and so robust and just the mechanics of running, period, coming into Strava, I was immediately able to identify various gaps, whether it be within the product thinking and solving process alone, or whether it be within our value prop within the market, or even if it was product market fit. And so coming from that environment, I was able to really own in and identify little things that could be quick little wins. And so within that, the roles and responsibilities kind of shifted. And so my first task there was to hold a, I would say, monetization value proposition sprint. And so within that, you apply design methodologies and you start with just a robust understanding for the people you're solving for, but also have the business needs in mind and in parallel. And then you marry those. But so that was kind of the essence of how I got into Strava. It was from left field. I did not expect to be doing the company's charter or moving things behind a paywall, but also very, very fortunate and like thankful for the opportunity. But it's a bit of a wild ride.
It's rare we get somebody that represents a product that we use all the time. Let's go back and unpack the where you sort of started at Strava. You talked about holding a monetization and value prop sprint. You also talked about Strava is not yet profitable. So help give a little bit of context of where Strava is in its life cycle and why you're there at a unique time when it comes to monetization.
So historically, we've had a lot of outside consultants. And so before my time, but we had a lot of people influencing how to structure the right type of payment model or subscription model. And so we've gone through the gamut, whether it be breaking up in tiers and packs, whether it be one isolated product, very differentiated from the free experience. And so it's been a bit of a journey. And so, and starting there, initially I was allotted to be on our, what we call mobile record. And so essentially you go to the mobile device, you tap record and your activities will be tracked and you can actually have those inputs upload to Strava. And so within that, priorities shifted pretty quickly. And so fortunately, after identifying some gaps within just a ways of working and not thinking there's an actual product market fit, it kind of came onto the plate of me, myself, one of our new hires, the product marketing director from Uber. We kind of just got in a room and went heads down. And that started off of like defining outputs, understanding all of the knowledge that was there and kind of looking through the complete threshold and gamut of everything that has been collected over time. So a lot of that was within our external hires that gave us this tiered structure, identifying why that didn't work. Also looking at if Strava is even worth paying for. And so if there's not a value that's displayed, people won't put their credit card out at all. It was about maybe a 5-day sprint. And so a lot of it was in discovery mode, which is just the understanding piece of the pie, where you just literally take all the knowledge you can and try to synthesize and extract key learnings and start to build an affinity map around that and some type of thematics to actually guide your next steps. And so within that, we realized that our free product was too good. A lot of our things that kind of set us apart and within our competitors were free. And a lot of things that didn't actually provide a lot of value were in our subscription model. And so it just seemed like a natural next step to start rethinking that framework and understanding, one, how long will this take to reverse engineer from an ideal state and understand if we can build this out incrementally, how much engineering time, because we can't just reconfigure an entire app and a paywall model without making improvements. If you just move things behind a paywall, but you don't actually better them, it's really not really kind or authentic. And so we had to identify and break down all the various levels of how to make that shift within a quick way in order to become profitable.
How are you making sure that people who are on that free tier are still finding a lot of value, but are also aware of what they could have if they became a subscriber?
Yeah, I think it's from every little interaction point. It's not within just like a singular growth team that implements upsells and ways or interstitials to get them into a paid model. It's within little hints of this features actually will provide X amount of value. Say there's a toggle and you can adjust your fitness, and if you go to the far right, it insinuates that your fitness will be better over time, whatever type of axes you want to describe. So it's got to be embedded. It has to be intrinsic. So with the role within product design within that is to do that in a seamless way where it doesn't interrupt an experience or an action they want to take. And so making it completely fluid and train of, like their train of thought is the biggest value any type of product design can have.
Ava, I don't know if there's a good way to answer this, but it's almost like the counter to what we're talking about. So in that example you just described, how do you, we've talked about opportunities to use design to affect positive change. On the flip side, how do you determine when you've done something wrong or something's having a negative effect? How do you figure out that, oh, actually that's not doing the thing that we think is the right thing to do?
I always like to use the poisonous cookie metaphor. It's where if one person eats it, dies, okay, maybe it's not poisonous, maybe it's a nuance with the person or physiology, like any type of thing going on. Two people eat the same cookie, both die, probably something up with the cookie. And so when I think about that within a product realm, users will tell you everything. If there is something in our logging as far as like a some type of interaction you want to track and understand a little bit further, we'll log it and understand it from a quantitative stance and look at that data. And we can see things happening or going differently within that. But then we can also place a qualitative study, whether it be a usability study or whether it be identifying where we've had. So for instance, say the logging is at the completion screen of the payment. And so a lot of people are dropping off. And so naturally you can assume and make some kind of guesses around some things that are happening. Maybe they don't want to pay right away. Maybe they don't see the value. Maybe there's an actual bug and then they can't actually complete the task. So when you look at it in that sense and you kind of like triangulate all of the inputs of quantitative, qualitative, and then just what you have known within the interaction space and just like empirical data, then you can actually say something's up. It's the same with the cookie.
I mean, so everyone has to support a wide range of users, but you have very, very extreme ends on your users. And I'm just curious about how you support that.
You're so right. And so we've made the issue in the past, that's a great question, as trying to cover every single realm of possibility. And then you obviously can't do everything well at that point. And so what we focus on a lot is the invested athlete. And so that does carry some type of generalization. Yes, invested athlete. So you could be a different athletic point in time of your life cycle and be more invested than not, or say there's an injury and then you're less invested. And so what we do try to focus on is the user base that wants regular cadence, that needs tracking, that needs something to kind of perpetuate them forward. But then folks, everyone kind of reaches that stage at some point, and even if they don't, we still provide a level of feature sets that can actually speak to their needs as well. But we do try to focus on the people that really are motivated.
I have one more question. I think we've covered it a little bit, but I'd be remiss if I didn't cover maybe the role of being a designer, because I'm a designer. I talk to a lot of designers today still, and one of the things that I continue to hear from designers is that they, well, designers always want to like do strategy, whatever they think strategy means. They always want to do something more with design. That's not just like UI design or pixel pushing or whatever sort of derogatory term you want to use. But when I hear you describe your career, you tell the story as if you're finding things outside of what maybe the lane is for design. A lot of times it almost seems like it's out there, but you almost have to just like make your own path to get there. That's kind of what I'm hearing from you, both at Facebook and Instagram, and then again at Strava. You didn't set out to do these specific things, but yet somehow you found your way there. So if you can look back on that, what would you advise another designer that's craving more? What should they be looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if you look at the landscape of design within San Francisco, and just whether it be the big corporations, TurboTech, it's Instagram, Facebook, what have you, and Strava even, like every designer that I intersect with has the most unique way that they actually got into design here in this environment. And so a lot of it, honestly, is just being open to experiences, not necessarily having this forecast of the career that you necessarily want, but just plugging yourself in places where you think you'll grow and learn from. And having a good design eye and aesthetic lies within being able to see so much and being able to understand the value that it's like adding into the environment or the value that it's taking away. And so being able to see those nuances in your day to day, that comes through travel, that comes through perpetual learning and having a beginner's mindset and always trying to have self-betterment attitude. And so, yes, you can have your interaction degree now, you can have your product design degree now, but you're not going to be a great product designer if you're not actually using the same type of methodologies in your day to day in the world. So I think that is it, just having an open mindset, and to even if like you have some opportunity to go on a farm and who knows where, to just for 6 months take it, because that'll build into the narrative and into the value that you bring to the table at any point.
Join us next week as we continue the series on the impact of product design. I'm Anna.
And I'm Christian, and this is Better Product.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you're looking for more resources on how to design, build, market, and sell better products, then head over to betterproduct.community to join, well, the community. And as always, we're curious, what does better product mean to you? Shoot us an email at podcasts@innovatemap.com.